Isn't it better to listen to the people's hopes now rather than their curses later? And yet, despite our differences, there is one common hope that brought us all to make this common pilgrimage. The hope that mankind will one day beat its swords into plowshares. The hope of peace. No place on earth. Today is peace more in need of friends than the Middle East. Its people's yearning for peace is growing. The United States will continue to be an active partner in the efforts of the parties to come together to settle their differences and build a just and lasting peace. And this month marks the beginning of the 8th year of the Iran-Iraq War. 2 months ago, the Security Council adopted a mandatory resolution demanding a ceasefire, withdrawal, and negotiations to end the war. The United States fully supports implementation of Resolution 598, as we support the Secretary General's recent mission. We welcomed Iraq's acceptance of that resolution and remain disappointed at Iran's unwillingness to accept it. In that regard, I know that the President of Iran will be addressing you tomorrow. I take this opportunity to call upon him clearly and unequivocally to state whether Iran accepts 598 or not. If the answer is positive, it would be a welcome step and major breakthrough. If it is negative, the Council has no choice but rapidly to adopt enforcement measures. For 40 years, the United States has made it clear its vital interest in the security of the Persian Gulf and the countries that border it. The oil reserves there are of strategic importance to the economies of the free world. We're committed to maintaining the free flow of this oil and to preventing the domination of the region by any hostile power. We do not seek confrontation or trouble with Iran or anyone else. Our object is, our objective is now and has been at every stage, finding a means to end the war with no victor and no vanquished. The increase in our naval presence in the Gulf does not favor one side or the other. It is a response to heightened tensions and followed consultations with our friends in the region. When the tension diminishes, so will our presence. The United States is gratified by many recent diplomatic developments. The unanimous adoption of Resolution 598, the Arab League's statement at its recent meeting in Tunis, and the Secretary General's visit. Yet, problems remain. The Soviet Union helped in drafting and reaching an agreement on Resolution 598, but outside the Security Council, the Soviets have acted differently. They called for removal of our Navy from the Gulf, where it has been for 40 years. They made the false accusation that somehow the United States, rather than the war itself, is the source of tension in the Gulf. Well, such statements are not helpful. They divert attention from the challenge facing us all, a just end to the war. The United States hopes the Soviets will join the other members of the Security Council in vigorously seeking an end to a conflict that never should have begun, should have ended long ago, and has become one of the great tragedies of the post-war era. Elsewhere in the region, we see the continuing Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. After nearly 8 years, 1 million casualties, nearly 4 million others driven into exile, and more intense fighting than ever, it's time for the Soviet Union to leave. The Afghan people must have the right to determine their own future, free of foreign coercion. There is no excuse for prolonging a brutal war or propping up a regime whose days are clearly numbered. That regime offers political proposals that pretend compromise, but really would ensure the perpetuation of the regime's power. Those proposals have failed the only significant test. They have been rejected by the Afghan people. Every day, the resistance grows in strength. It is an indispensable party in the quest for a negotiated solution. The world community must continue to insist on genuine self-determination, prompt and full Soviet withdrawal, and the return of the refugees to their homes in safety and honor. The attempt may be made to pressure a few countries to change their vote this year, but this body I know will vote overwhelmingly, as every year before, for Afghan independence and freedom. We have noted General Secretary Gorbachev's statement of readiness to withdraw. In April, I asked the Soviet Union to set a date this year when this withdrawal would begin. I repeat that request now in this forum for peace. I pledge that once the Soviet Union shows convincingly that it's ready for a genuine political settlement, the United States is ready to be helpful. Let me add one final note on this matter. Pakistan, in the face of enormous pressure and intimidation, has given sanctuary to Afghan refugees. We salute the courage of Pakistan and the Pakistani people. They deserve strong support from all of us. Another regional conflict we all know is taking place in Central America, in Nicaragua. To the Sandinista delegation here today, I say, your people know the true nature of your regime. They have seen their liberties suppressed. They have seen the promises of 1979 go unfulfilled. They have seen their real wages and personal income fall by half, yes, half, since 1979, while your party elite live lives of privilege and luxury. This is why, despite $1 billion in Soviet bloc aid last year alone, despite the largest and best equipped army in Central America, you face a popular revolution at home. It is why the democratic resistance is able to operate freely deep in your heartland. But this revolution should come as no surprise to you. It is only the revolution you promised the people and that you then betrayed. The goal of United States policy toward Nicaragua is simple. It is the goal of the Nicaraguan people and the freedom fighters as well. It is democracy, real, free, pluralistic, constitutional democracy. Understand this, we will not, and the world community will not accept phony democratization designed to mask the perpetuation of dictatorship. In this 200th year of our own Constitution, we know that real democracy depends on the safeguards of an institutional structure that prevents a concentration of power. It is that which makes rights secure. The temporary relaxation of controls, which can later be tightened, is not democratization. And again to the Sandinistas, I say, we continue to hope that Nicaragua will become part of the genuine transformation, democratic transformation, that we have seen throughout Central America in this decade. We applaud the principles embodied in the Guatemala Agreement, which links the security of the Central American democracies to democratic reform in Nicaragua. Now is the time for you to shut down the military machine that threatens your neighbors and assaults your own people. You must end your stranglehold on internal political activity. You must hold free and fair national elections. The media must be truly free, not censored or intimidated or crippled by indirect measures like the denial of newsprint or threats against journalists or their families. Exiles must be allowed to return to minister, to live, to work, and to organize politically. Then, when persecution of religion is ended and the jails no longer contain political prisoners, national reconciliation and democracy will be possible. Unless this happens, democratization will be a fraud. And until it happens, we will press for true democracy by supporting those fighting for it. Freedom in Nicaragua, or Angola, or Afghanistan, or Cambodia, or Eastern Europe, or South Africa, or any place else on the globe, is not just an internal matter. Some time ago, the Czech dissident writer Václav Havel warned the world that respect for human rights is the fundamental condition and the sole genuine guarantee of true peace. And Andrei Sakharov, in his Nobel lecture, said, I am convinced that international confidence, mutual understanding, disarmament, and intentional security are inconceivable without an open society with freedom of information, freedom of conscience, the right to publish, and the right to travel and choose the country in which one wishes to live. Freedom serves peace. The quest for peace must serve the cause of freedom. Patient diplomacy can contribute to a world in which both can flourish. We're heartened by new prospects for improvement in East-West and particularly U.S.-Soviet relations. Last week, Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze visited Washington for talks with me and with the Secretary of State, Shultz. We discussed the full range of issues, including my long-standing efforts to achieve, for the first time, deep reductions in U.S. and Soviet nuclear arms. It was 6 years ago, for example, that I proposed the zero option for U.S. and Soviet longer-range, intermediate-range nuclear missiles. I'm pleased that we have now agreed in principle to a truly historic treaty that will eliminate an entire class of U.S. and Soviet nuclear weapons. We also agreed to intensify our diplomatic efforts in all areas of mutual interest. Toward that end, Secretary Shultz and the Foreign Minister will meet again a month from now in Moscow. And I will meet again with General Secretary Gorbachev later this fall. We continue to have our differences and probably always will. But that puts a special responsibility on us to find ways, realistic ways, to bring greater stability to our competition and to show the world a constructive example of the value of communication and of the possibility of peaceful solutions to political problems. And here let me add that we seek, through our strategic defense initiative, to find a way to keep peace through relying on defense, not offense, for deterrence and for eventually rendering ballistic missiles obsolete. SDI has greatly enhanced the prospects for real arms reduction. It is a crucial part of our efforts to ensure a safer world and a more stable strategic balance. We will continue to pursue the goal of arms reduction, particularly the goal that the General Secretary and I agreed upon, a 50% reduction in our respective strategic nuclear arms. We will continue to press the Soviets for more constructive conduct in the settling of regional conflicts. We look to the Soviets to honor the Helsinki Accords. We look for greater freedom for the Soviet peoples within their country, more people-to-people exchanges with our country, and Soviet recognition in practice of the right of freedom of movement. We look forward to a time when things we now regard as sources of friction and even danger can become examples of cooperation between ourselves and the Soviet Union. For instance, I have proposed a collaboration to reduce the barriers between East and West in Berlin, and more broadly in Europe as a whole. Let us work together for a Europe in which force of the threat or force, whether in the form of walls or of guns, is no longer an obstacle to free choice by individuals and whole nations. Conflicts that are potential flashpoints for wider conflict. I pointed out how difficult it is for the United States to accept Soviet assurances of peaceful intent when 126,000 Soviet troops prosecute a vicious war against the Afghan people, when 140,000 Soviet-backed Vietnamese soldiers wage war on the people of Cambodia, when 1,700 Soviet advisors and 2,500 Cuban combat troops are involved in military planning and operations in Ethiopia, when 1,300 Soviet military advisors and 36,000 Cuban troops direct and participate in combat operations to prop up an unpopular repressive regime in Angola, when hundreds of millions of dollars in Soviet arms and Soviet bloc advisors help a dictatorial regime in Nicaragua try to subvert and betray a popular revolution. The danger inherent in these conflicts must be recognized. Marxist-Leninist regimes tend to wage war as readily against their neighbors as they routinely do against their own people. In fact, the internal and external wars often become indistinguishable. In Afghanistan, for example, the puppet regime has announced its intention to relocate tens of thousands of people from border areas. Can anyone doubt this will be done in classic communist style by force? Many will die to make it easier for the Soviets and their satellite troops to intimidate Pakistan. It is just such transgressions that make the risk of confrontation with democratic nations so acute. So once again, I propose a three-point peace process for the resolution of regional conflicts. First, talks between the warring parties themselves, without which an end to violence and national reconciliation are impossible. Second, discussions between the United States and Soviet Union, not to impose solutions, but to support peace talks and eventually eliminate the supply of arms and the proxy troops from abroad. And third, if the talks are successful, joint efforts to welcome each country back into the world economy and the community of nations that respect human rights. In addition to regional disputes, the grave threat of terrorism also jeopardized the hopes for peace. No cause, no grievance can justify it. Terrorism is heinous and intolerable. It is the crime of cowards, cowards who prey on the innocent, the defenseless, and the helpless. With its allies and other nations, the United States has taken steps to counter terrorism directly, particularly state-sponsored terrorism. Last April, the United States demonstrated that it will defend its interests and act against terrorist aggression. And let me assure all of you today, especially let me assure any potential sponsors of terrorism, that the American people are of one mind on this issue. Like other civilized peoples of the world, we have reached our limit. Attacks against our citizens or our interests will not go unanswered. We will also do all in our power to help other law-abiding nations threatened by terrorist attacks. To that end, the United States believes that the understandings reached by the seven industrial democracies at the Tokyo summit last May made a good start toward international accord in the war on terrorism. We recommend to the General Assembly consideration of the Tokyo resolutions. Moving to the economic realm, how ironic it is that some continue to espouse such ideas as a new international economic order based on state control, when the world is learning as never before that the freedom of the individual, not the power of the state, is the key to economic dynamism and growth. Nations have turned away from centralized management and government controls and toward the incentives and rewards of the free market. They have invited their citizens to develop their talents and abilities to the fullest, and in the process, to provide jobs, to create wealth, to build social stability and foster faith in the future for all. The economic summits of the industrial democracies have paid tribute to these principles, as has the historic UN Special Session on Africa in May. We applaud the African nations' call for reform, leading to greater reliance on their private sectors for economic growth. We believe that overcoming hunger and economic stagnation requires policies that encourage Africans' own productivity and initiatives. Such a policy framework will make it easier for the rest of the world, including the United States, to help. The laws of economic incentives do not discriminate between developed and developing countries. They apply to all equally. Much of the recent recovery in the world economy can be directly attributed to this growth of economic freedom. And it is this trend that offers such hope for the future. And yet, this new hope faces a grave threat, the menace of trade barriers. History shows the imposition of such barriers invites retaliation, which in turn sparks the very sort of trade wars that plunged the world in the 1930s deeper into depression and economic misery. Truly, protectionism is destructionism. That is why the United States seeks the assistance of all countries represented here in the General Assembly in protecting the practice of free and fair trade. We applaud the success of the meeting of GATT trade ministers last week in Uruguay, where agreement was reached to launch a new round of multilateral trade negotiations covering a wide range of topics important to economic growth. With over 90 other countries of the GATT,
the United States is working to maintain the free flow of international trade. In addition to resistance to protectionism, the United States is also seeking to stimulate world economic growth in other ways. Our Treasury bill interest rate is now just over 5%, the lowest it has been in 9 years, which provides enormous relief to debtor countries. America's new tax structure will open the way for greater prosperity at home, which will contribute to greater prosperity abroad. And finally, the United States is working with other countries to minimize currency swings, to promote stability in the monetary markets, to establish predictability as a basis for prosperity. But the United States believes the greatest contribution we can make to world prosperity is the continued advocacy of the magic of the marketplace. The truth, the simple and proven truth, that economic development is an outgrowth of economic freedom, just as economic freedom is the inseparable twin of political freedom and democratic government. And it is here that we come to our final category, human rights, the indispensable element for peace, freedom, and prosperity. I note that Mr. Gorbachev has used in recent speeches the same categories I have used here today, the military, the political, and the economic, except that he titled his fourth category humanitarian. Well, the difference is revealing. The United States believes that respect for the individual, for the dignity of the human person, those rights outlined in the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights, does not belong in the realm of charity or humanitarian causes. Respect for human rights is not social work. It is not merely an act of compassion. It is the first obligation of government and the source of its legitimacy. It also is the foundation stone in any structure of world peace. All through history, it has been the dictatorships and the tyrannies that have surrendered first to the cult of militarism and the pursuit of war. Countries based on the consent of the governed, countries that recognize the unalienable rights of the individual, do not make war on each other. Peace is more than just an absence of war. True peace is justice. True peace is freedom. And true peace dictates the recognition of human rights. Commitments were made more than 10 years ago in Helsinki concerning these rights and their recognition. We need only look to the East today to see how sadly unfulfilled those commitments are. The persecution of scientists, religious leaders, peace activists, political dissenters, and other prisoners of conscience continues unabated behind the Iron Curtain. You know, one section of the Helsinki Accords even speaks to, and I quote, improvement of working conditions of journalists. So it is clear the progress in the human rights area must keep pace with progress in other areas. A failure on this score will hinder further movement in East-West relations. These, then, are the areas of concern and of opportunity that the United States sees in the quest for peace and freedom, the twin objectives of the UN Charter. Last year, I pointed out in my address to the General Assembly the differences between the United States and the Soviet Union are deep and abiding. But I also called for a fresh start in relations between our two nations, a fresh start that could benefit our own people and the people of every nation. Since that time, the United States has taken action and put forth new proposals that could lead to our two countries and the entire world in a direction we all have long sought to go. Now more than ever, it is the response